Welcome to Inside Learning, episode 113 for the 22nd of May, 2013. Only phonicking.
Matthew, and how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good, Steve. I'm good. Still saddled with this cold. I'm feeling like a man with a sickly constitution. I think that's about a month I've had this cold, but I'm feeling okay. So yeah, and I'm feeling all the better for hearing you.
Well, it hasn't dented your warm Argyle brogue, so I'm looking forward to another evening of innovation and sparkling wit from the man from Argyle.
Do you know, the Scots never think of themselves as having a brogue, but other nations often attribute a brogue to us.
Must be the shoes. Anyway, I'm delighted tonight to welcome Louisa Hussey. So welcome to the programme, Louisa.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Hi, Louisa.
And hi, Matthew.
Louisa, you are, well, you're a deputy head, but you're currently acting head, aren't you? Because your boss is doing one of these weird executive things where he has to take over a failing school. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. So I'm still teaching, being deputy head, but kind of acting up a couple of days a week as well. So a bit of everything at the moment.
So feeling the stress, and we'll talk to you, have a conversation to you about English primary curriculum reform. And we haven't got a bleeper, so...
I shall be very well behaved.
That wouldn't be good for Steve then, because he'll have to make up for it then by being twice as badly behaved as he usually is. I'm always intrigued by that phrase, acting up. We still use that in Scotland as well, Louisa. And it always seems unfortunate that it's a phrase we use for misbehaving children as well.
Oh, that's true. I'd not thought of it that way. Yeah, good point. I'm being very well behaved in my acting up role, I hope.
Good.
Right, well, we will just kick off with any news items that struck us this week. Matthew, you start us off there.
Yeah, I've deliberately picked a short one so that we can get into our conversation with Louisa. The NASUWT, which is a big union in England, isn't it?
Yep.
But not a big union in Scotland, or a minority player, really, have called for positive discrimination in Scotland in schools, because the numbers of male teachers are shrinking rapidly. I don't know what the English situation is, but the Times Education Supplement Scotland has a nice little set of pie charts. I like pie charts, they're easy for me to understand. At the moment, 2012, they're saying primary, the gender division is 91% female, and in secondary, it's 62% female. And when you look at it in the pie charts, it's really obvious that what we have essentially is a pretty complete feminisation of the primary profession, and, you know, it's coming on for a sort of two-thirds feminisation of the secondary profession. And the story is just that they've called for it at a conference, and it seems to have caused a little controversy, because some people, even within the union, are saying, you know what, it's admirable and laudable, I can see why people are asking for it, but it's never going to happen, and essentially it should just be about the best person for the job anyway. And in fact, the article written by Henry Hepburn, I picked one of his articles last week as well, didn't I, Steve?
Yeah.
He's basically saying that people are privately expressing to him that they were surprised that it carried through as a motion. But just for me personally, it reminded me of the Tony Blair era. Do you remember the dreadful, and I thought very unkind insults about Blair's babes, you know, when they used positive discrimination then to up the number of party members, it was actually MPs, wasn't it?
You know, from women MPs,
female side.
All women shortlist,
At the time, I remember a lot of people saying to me, "No, that's just wrong. You just have to have the right person for the job, you know." And it seemed pretty straightforward. But I never bought that. I always thought, well, the problem isn't really about a meritocracy there, or whatever. It's about culture. You know, that there are lots of cultural reasons why not sufficient women were able to get into Parliament, and forcing the issue was arguably helpful. You know, and I just wonder if we have reached a stage with the primary teaching, certainly in Scotland, whereby, you know, it isn't any longer the case that it's about just getting the right person for the job. Yeah. Lots of men just don't feel that they want to be considered, you know, culturally in a world that's so feminized. I mean, I've talked to lots of young male teachers that have said, you know, it has been an issue. You know, you do kind of worry if people think you're going into it because you're, you know, you're somehow a bit weird. You know, yeah. Like, especially in the, yeah, you know, sure. the culture the of fear about stage. Children and child protection now. Mm. So, yeah. I think it's. I mean, I've said a number of times in the podcast, Steve, although not for a long while, that I think it is a serious issue for us. And oh, well, there you go, Henny SUWT. Apparently, by a whisker, a slight majority also think it's a serious issue. Yeah.
So what's the balance in your school between male and female teachers, Louisa?
We are, well, male head teacher and one male member of staff for 7 year groups. So 6 full-time equivalent female members of staff and one male member of staff. We do have 2 very regular male supply teachers, but otherwise just one plus the head teacher. Yeah. So, but it was interesting you're saying that, Matthew, though, because our male teacher is in Key Stage 1. He's our Key Stage 1 leader. And he is often quite concerned that people think that he's in there for kind of the wrong reasons, which is, it's really sad. And it's actually made him, it's made him kind of the age he is, think of moving out of the classroom to doing something different just because of other people's perceptions, actually. So when he's a fantastic teacher and needs to stay there, and the children need him.
Yeah,
it's terrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
When we get to that risk stage. It's interesting that the both the men in your schools are in leadership positions,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
men in the minority, yeah, but probably in the majority of...
Yeah, well, we're 50-50 for our senior leadership team, but yeah.
Yeah.
But both male members of staff on the SLT.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think of it in terms of, like, the role model aspect? I did read a research somewhere saying that actually male role models for younger children didn't seem to make much impact in terms of results.
I believe Jay brought that story up when he was last, or at least when he was on the podcast more regularly. And I think it was specifically literacy, Steve, wasn't it? The study was looking at that,
right.
The effect on that, and they found there was no significant effect. But I remember questioning at the time that, you know, the study may well have been a little bit narrow. There might be lots of other effects that are, not being measured there.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, from your perspective, Louisa, that actually male role models are a good thing to have in school, or doesn't it matter? I mean,
I think, again, it's about the person, isn't it? And a role model is a role model, and you can have good role models, and you can have less good role models. I think it's good for the children to see the male role models, I think particularly the lower end of the school, because there's a lot of that association, particularly sort of in the catchment area where that I am. There's kind of that association that women still do those kind of the more caring jobs, the more caring professions, and it's kind of seen, isn't it, that the Key Stage 1 end is like that. And I think it's good to have the male teachers lower down the school. But interestingly, we still have lots of parents as well that think that if you have a male teacher, they are automatically more important than the female teachers. And it's really shocking, actually. And in the same way that if you then have taught in Key Stage 1 and you perhaps move into Key Stage 2, that you have in some way been promoted, because obviously it's much trickier there. So it's a similar thing, I think. So
actually, it reminds me of an old story about one of the, what's his name, Sir Keith, one of the Tory Secretaries of State for Education, right old backwoodsman. Oh, you know, my memory's gone. But I remember he... going around, he visited a primary school and said to the head teacher, "Oh, when are you going to get promotion then to secondary school?"
Is that a true story?
Yeah, it's a true story.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, it was one of the old Tory dinosaurs. Yeah. Do you know, I wish I could remember his name. Anyway, moving on. Yeah, well, that kind of raises quite a number of issues.
Well, just briefly, before you move on, would either of you be open now to a positive discrimination? This union's calling for a target of 30% males.
I would. Yeah.
I don't know. I would have to think about that one. I think it's about the right person for the job. I think it's very difficult attracting men into the profession. I don't know why. I don't know why.
Hmm.
Well, it's hard attracting anybody into profession at the moment, isn't it? But there's another whole story. There's another story together. I think possibly yes, but
okay. Yeah, you'd need more
thinking time. Yeah, sprung that one on you there. Sorry, Lisa.
Yeah, you do need. Yeah, you're right. Perhaps I need to think about it more as well. Anyway, I just another quick story, which thanks to one of our contributors, Charlie Love, who I picked up on Twitter. So big up to Twitter for keeping me in the loop here. He tweeted a story about revision techniques, and there's a paper which you can download for free, research paper, which says in the study that 8 out of 10 popular revision techniques do not work, but there are 2 that do. I thought it was a very apposite story at this time of year. It's a Professor Dunlovsky who's reviewed a number of techniques, for example, you know, that summaries, highlighting, highlighter pens. He said highlighter pens are basically, I think, a waste of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Revision.
They are pretty. Yeah, I always joke when I'm doing study skills sessions for youngsters that their main worth is in getting you sympathy and a chocolate biscuit from your dad.
Yeah.
Because he's so convinced that you're working hard when he sees all that lovely marking.
Yeah. Anyway, the two that come out top obviously is actually planning and do it well in advance. He said it makes the analogy that if you were a kind of dancer, you wouldn't be rehearsing your dance at the last minute. And then actually repeating testing yourself. So just keep reading, keep testing. So it's repetition of the testing. So I just thought it was interesting because, you know, we can make a lot of assumptions, don't we, about what works in some of these techniques. And it's good to have some research to think about it a bit more.
Mm. Yeah, we must do a whole program on that one night, you know, just looking at the different techniques.
Yeah, and the sort of the cognitive aspects of it. I mean, he said mnemonics are good for some things, you know, like Richard York, et cetera. He said, but they're not always transferable, you know, they don't work in every subject.
Yeah, they're somewhat limited, aren't they?
So I thought just an interesting story at this. And then he kind of gives it, you know, he gives them a rating of a kind of moderate success, low success, I think high success. So the highest, as I said, was distributed practice, spreading out the study over a long period of time and self-testing, practice testing, you know, to doing some maybe using a flashcard and then testing yourself on what it's saying.
Well, that's interesting. I'd always kind of homed in from my reading on certainly the over a long period of time thing squares with my reading as well, you know, that you should be planning it 6 weeks, 2 months or more in advance to, you know, to really target the right things. But also that, you know, it was about moving from passive studying, you know, which is like so your highlighter pens or copying out passages, to active, you know, which would be teaching others. You know, getting your mum and dad to sit and, you know, they ask you what you've been learning so that you can try and say it aloud and think it through, or even teaching your dog.
Yeah.
For the price of a few Bonio, you could have a nice patient dog sitting in front of you learning all about the background factors to the Second War.
That's a bit apt for you, Steve, you see.
Well, I don't. Yes, well, I think Molly's just been trying to kick the kitchen door down and you're howling downstairs because I'm afraid she's not with Daddy. I don't think Molly would sit still long enough for me to...
Daddy. Not with Daddy.
Oh, sorry.
This pup has got under your skin, Stevie.
But she's very cute.
Have you met her, Louisa? Yeah.
I have. She's brilliant.
She's beautiful. Yeah. She did feature on one of her blog pictures, was it 2 weeks ago, Steve? And she added a bit of class to her podcast, I have to say.
She burst upstairs into the room, leapt onto my lap in the middle of a podcast. It's like, I think, shocked Matthew, said, oh, what's that?
That's my dog.
Didn't shock me at all. Delighted me. Absolutely delighted me. She's
good
absolutely beautiful.
Good old Molly.
Yeah. Anyway, Louisa, that's a quick roundup on the news, but the kind of main meat of the podcast was we wanted to have a conversation with you about current trends in English primary curriculum. As I say, we've got a reform moves gathering apace.
Yeah.
I know under New Labour, there were kind of 2 reviews, weren't there? So the Cambridge Review, the Independent Review, then is it the Rose Review? So, I mean, what's the current sort of state of play with you in English primary?
The current state of play is a bit tricky at the moment because we don't really have anything officially to go on at the moment because we're kind of we're in a bit of a state of flux between waiting for the new curriculum, which we have the draft for at the moment, don't we? Well, the consultation and then waiting to see what happens. But at the moment, we're all at it with the phonics, as we've been told to with our Rose Review. So that's happening. We're all grammaring away so that we can all make sure that we're reaching where we should be with our SPAG test, which we've had the first one in the SATs last week.
A SPAG test. Not something you put on a...
No, not your bolognese.
With a meatball on top, no.
No. Spelling, punctuation and grammar, Steve. Ooh. Spelling, punctuation and grammar. So we had the first one of those in SATs last week. I was quite heavily involved at the beginning of the whole Rose Review and phonics coming in. I helped advise Key Stage 1 teachers across the local authority. And I'm all right with phonics. I quite like phonics. The kids like it. They learn. You still have the children who learn slower than others, and you have those who learn quicker than others, and you have those who, quite frankly, it is never going to work for, but, you know, you have to cater for them in different ways. I think where a phonics falls down is that if you're only phonicking, you're missing out on so much more, aren't you, really? It needs to be, you know, it needs to be alongside the things. And I think the danger is with, you know, the big focus on phonics that you're losing out on that real enjoyment of reading. So, and I speak for that being a teacher and being a mother with a son that's just started school and doing his phonics.
Not too keen, is he?
No, well, he loves reading, but he's not too keen on... And he knows his phonics, and he doesn't mind doing his phonics sessions at school, basically because he completely loves his teacher. But kind of the connecting the two together is not quite there in his head, and I think that's where a lot of it falls down. You know, there needs to be some really good quality teaching and links between that, you know, the richness of the reading for pleasure and kind of learning to decode those words and fitting them together to make sense, because otherwise you've got one without the other, and that doesn't work. So
you're not doing phonics to the exclusion of everything else
Not. I mean, you know, in the jam-packed curriculum at school, what we've done is somehow shoehorned a 20 minutes phonics session every day. Our school's actually, this is the only thing that we target group for. We're a one form entry school, 210 in the school, and we have phonics or grammar, 13 different groups going out throughout the school with the children, either working with a teacher or a teaching assistant in small groups. That happens for 20 minutes every day, but then we also have our separate literacy sessions, which are away from the phonics, where we're trying to pick up all the different parts of reading, writing, and fit it all together. And, you know, it's working. It is working. But it's a big, you know, there really is a lot to think about. And there are going to be those children that don't learn to read necessarily using phonics. And that's, you know, it's going to be the case. So you have to make sure that there are other things in place for those children.
Can I just ask a quick question as the secondary background person here? First of all, I just have to observe that I'm still tickled pink by your use of the phrase there, only phonicking. I really like that. It's not about only phonicking. I'm sure there could be an episode title on that one, Steve. Yeah. John, I'm only phonicking.
Phonicking through the daisies.
Phonicking.
yeah, there could be a bleep to make it more interesting, actually. But it strikes me that this is an area that I hear there's a lot of research on. In fact, I'm sure I read that it is the area that's got the most research on it internationally. I, my question would really be, you know, is there still any ambiguity about what the right balance is? You know, do we now know how to, you know, put phonics in the mix in the right way, or is that a naive hope?
I think we're kind of getting there. It's been a few years now since the Rose Review, since we've all been implementing it, and I think we're starting to get a balance, and we're understanding now how it's have an impact on the children's learning. It's what I find difficult is that the phonics sessions that we teach, and we have these 20 minutes discrete sessions that are away from everything else, with, you know, succinct stages that we have to go through. We go through, we start off with phase one that runs on by alongside everything, and we go from phase two to phase six, kind of getting all our graphene and phoneme correspondences and working up to learning about suffixes and prefixes and correct words for spellings. The 20 minutes, it's very quick, it's very fast, it's very dry. There's not a lot of excitement in there necessarily, because it is kind of, it's that bang, 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 bang. There we are. That's what we're doing. And that is fine. That's fine. But there's, and it does work. But again, it's like when you think about your numeracy skills, isn't it? You learn your abstracts separately, but you've got to apply them, and you've got to, they've got to work with your learning. And with, it's that whole kind of going from learning to read to reading to learn. And it's very difficult to get from your phonics and then understanding that what you're doing with your teacher, with your teaching assistant, with who, whichever adult you're working with your parent at home, that then that is what makes the richness of the language, and that's what makes books fit together. And that's, you know, the part that goes with it. I think we're getting there with a balance, but.
So is that down in just, a sense to the skill and of the teacher to make that transfer happen?
I think so. I think it is. And it's difficult.
So there's a limit to what you can prescribe in a sense, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I think it's parents knowing as well that actually the phonics is very important, but it's not actually the be all and end all of learning to read. And it's really important. It's about the information as well, isn't it? It's about sharing things with parents. I mean, at our school, we have an evening every year where we explain how we are approaching the teaching of reading. We talk about, you know, the research behind it and why we are approaching reading in this way. But there's still very much kind of the parental worry that then they're not doing it properly because they're not necessarily sounding out the phonemes that necessarily that their child is sounding them out in the same way. And the whole kind of worry about if they can't read this specific word that's got six phonemes, or it's got a trigraph in, or it's got a digraph in. And it's, I think parents find that in itself a bit of a pressure. And then that's difficult for the children at home when half of the learning to read is really sharing those books for pleasure, isn't it? And, you know, enjoying it. And that, you don't want to get away from the joy of reading, which I think can be, can be difficult.
So do you, and so you've got a new phonics test at Key Stage 1?
We have, started last year.
What age are those, just for the non-?
So that's, you know, that's year one children, so 5 and 6 year olds.
5 and 6 year olds. Yeah. And so how does that test work then with them?
It's one-to-one with their teacher. They have, I could be wrong, I think it's 50 words and they have to read 35. I could be wrong, so don't quote me on that one.
Right.
And it's short CVC words, which nowadays when we say CVC, we don't necessarily mean consonant, vowel, consonant. We mean phoneme, and another phoneme. So, for example, you could have, which
cat?
Would... Cat, yes, well done, Matthew. Cat is
I'm trying to keep up for you.
Well done. You might have which, for example, which would be woo for W-E-W-I-C-H. And your, even though that's a 5-lettered word, your ch at the end of which is your TCH, which is one phoneme. So you'd have a number of, CVC words for the children to read, but they may have more than 3 letters. But they are not necessarily real words, which is where it gets, think it's quite tricky. So you might have, BAV, you might have BAV, and the children have got to read that word. So what the phonics test is actually testing is how they can blend the words to read, not necessarily how they can read words, if that makes, does that make sense?
Yep.
Got you. Yeah.
Interesting.
So it is interesting. I mean, a couple of questions there is, I mean, does that, If that test is publicly accountable, is it having an impact on the way you're teaching? And secondly, I'll answer one question at a time. I mean, does it kind of distort the teaching, or is it just something you...
I don't think it does. I don't think it does distort the teaching because, you know, we all know in our heart of hearts as good practitioners what we need to be doing. So we know that there's a process that you go through with the phonemes, and we know that kind of one of those earliest stages of learning to read is learning to blend those words together to be able to read, so that it becomes automatic, so that you can see a word as a whole. However, an interesting thing with the phonics test is that actually one of the things that I found from last year is some of our really good readers might not necessarily reach the pass mark because because they've moved on from that blending and are seeing the whole word. And then, so if they see B-A-V, bav, to them, that's not
it's
the word.
It's nonsense, yeah.
So it's nonsense. Yeah. So they're kind of, what does that say?
You're making people slow down in a way that's uncomfortable for them. Yeah. Actually, you're bringing back some very interesting memories for me. I know this is a wee bit off the main flow, but do either of you ever remember ITA?
Yes.
I learned when I was a primary one child in Scotland. I learned to read with ITA, which was a...
Is that where you learn completely different
symbols for the sounds?
And then you just have to relearn,
So like the oo sound was like a double circular squiggle, and a W was like a, you know, like an italicized W, you know. If you're learning something like ice cream, there was a symbol for the I sound, the EI sound, and it actually looked like an EI drawn together.
Because that's what they put in.
EI, and it wasn't a C, it was an A, it was like a symbol for S. So ice cream was the symbol EI together, and then an S, and cream was CR, and there was a double E symbol, which was for the long E sound. And then M. So you can imagine how this is messed up with my sense of spelling even 40 years later.
It's interesting.
If you're interested, actually, you can still find the phonetic symbols on Wikipedia. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Gosh.
I mean, so we're hoping that this is not a matter of the latest fashion, but is actually based on some good research, aren't we?
Yes.
Does the test then actually, does it test what it purports to test? I mean, you raised one problem with it. I mean, is it worthwhile or is it just so the government can tick a box? I mean.
Well, there we are. I'm not convinced of its value to informing our teaching and learning, but it does show us those children who are learning to blend words. However, I don't think it shows us anything new, and it's something that they're 5 and 6. They're 5 and 6 years old. I don't think it's necessarily a brilliant use of a teacher's time to spend 2 days going through one-to-one with each child, seeing if they can read words that aren't actually words.
Yeah.
But and it does identify those children who are struggling to blend. However, as a good teacher, as a good phonics teacher, as a good Key Stage 1 teacher, you know those children in your class because you know those children really well and you've taught them for a year. Yes. So I think you could, look at any of the 30 children in your class, if you're lucky enough to have a class as small as 30, and say, little Johnny there cannot blend sounds, but little Rowan can blend sounds. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
Another tick boxy, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, which kind of brings me to a more general point, which is the Cambridge Review, the Robin Alexander Review, was obviously very much in favour of trusting teachers and that kind of teacher judgment, and actually dispelled the myth that primary teachers weren't interested in the 3 R's and the basics, and said very much that actually primary schools are the one kind of one bright light of stability in childhood, and that childhood isn't as bad a state as everyone's making out. This government has a kind of contradictory thing going on. On the one hand, it's saying, well, we want to trust teachers. On the other hand, it's telling you that you're not doing a good enough job, early enough age, and we're going to test all these kids. I mean, does that come through in your work? I mean, that tension.
What, the lack of trust, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's, I love my job. I have never, ever wanted to do anything else other than my job. It's the only job I've ever had other than the jobs that I had in my holidays from university. But it's a very tough time to do the job, not because of you know, any problems with children, not necessarily because of the curriculum that we're having to teach, but just because it's very difficult to feel that you don't have the trust of people. And I don't feel that as a profession, I don't think that teachers do feel trusted, or that actually we are perceived as doing a good job. And 99% of us do absolutely work our little socks off, and for the right reasons. And it's a tricky time.
Louise, I feel you. I feel your pain there, and I can tell that you're not far off of a Steve Rogers level anti-English misgovernment of education rant. But I notice you're getting a few little pops there in your sound. Any chance of just moving your microphone a little bit to one side so that it's out of the way of your breath stream?
Is that any better?
I think so. Yeah. Just as long as it's just moved out of the way of your breath. Now you can go on with ranting again. Go for it.
Okay. No, I've calmed down when I'm in my ranting now.
Yeah, Steve will fire you up again, now that you're on this topic.
It's because one of the interesting things that seems to come across in the Conservative discourse is that we're not doing enough early enough with these young children.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, that actually the standards are not good. They're not going to secondary school well enough prepared. And yet... The international evidence seems to suggest, you know, and the child development evidence seems to suggest that actually there's a danger in doing too much too early.
Oh, absolutely. Completely agree with you, Steve, in every way. 100%. You're a very wise man.
Well, I mean, so you mentioned the old SPAG, you know, which kind of I still imagine myself sitting in some piazza in Italy.
Oh, if only.
If only, yeah. You know,
there's got to be some sort of a joke here about alphabeti spaghetti. But I haven't made it.
It's not been made at all before, Matthew. No.
Damn, you dealt with me.
but these punctuation and grammar tests, they're a new level, are they, of kind of standard that you're expected to do on top of?
Yeah. I mean, it was the grammar was always there, but because the SATs have changed over the last couple of years, because we went to a stage that writing was moderated internally, papers weren't necessarily sent off to be marked. We now, to get the year six SATs, now their level comes from a mixture of a separate spelling test, a timed writing, a short and a long, I think. Might be wrong, might just be one. And then the spelling, punctuation and grammar test. So there's the SPAG, there's the spelling, and then there's the writing task. So all of those then give them their level 3, 4, 5, 6, if you're very lucky. And it's not massively new in terms of what we're expecting the children to do in terms of the actual application of the writing, but the actual using the terminology. For example, we had a staff meeting early this year where we all had a bit of a chat about what we meant by a predicate in a sentence. And I have an English degree, and I have taught through Key Stage 2, Key Stage 1 and Foundation Stage, and never had I come across the word predicate.
Well, everyone knows it's an animal that eats other animals.
That's not true.
Sorry.
Well, yeah, but that's Gove's point. It just shows how badly educated you are.
Yeah, exactly. And I was a child that went to school in the early 1980s. So actually, you know, the fact that I managed to get my English degree and become a teacher, obviously, without understanding what a predicate was, is a bit of a problem. But
serious, I've been really impressed with your casual command of the, you know, the language of phonics and language teaching. It's interesting, you know, primary teachers don't often enough get praise in society for that level of expertise around the mechanics of language.
And we have to have an expertise in lots of areas as well, Matthew, remember? It's not just not just language. Think of all the subjects we have to teach in primary. You see?
I just complimented you and you managed to point out the deficiency in my compliment. How did that happen?
Oh, thanks, Matthew. That was very kind of you. But it is ingrained. It gets ingrained. The phonics stuff, it's in your head. It just, yeah. I don't know.
So how's your punctuation coming on?
My punctuation's not too bad. I'm getting a lot better now with my comma splicing.
Right.
I can do commas in it. Yeah.
Because I asked that because apparently a year six pupil wrote to the department saying that they, in the SATs test, they got their comma splicing wrong and actually pointed out to them that they weren't writing to the way that they were expected to write. Which I thought was brilliant. Yes,
people.
Isn't that wonderful?
So does that mean your diagnostic testing then in this area is essentially a colonoscopy?
Oh dear.
Oh, when we got the first draft of the first SPAG test through, there were two mistakes in it, I think, which was quite funny.
So there you go.
Could I ask just a little devil's advocate question? As a Scot, you know, we hear the English news, we don't know intimately or teach the English system. Successive ministers have sort of played down teacher fears around the SATs. You know, that, oh, they should just be taken in the stride, they shouldn't interfere with the teaching. What's your sense of the truth of that, Louisa? You know, as a school, do you guys just take whatever the new verse of the SAT is in your stride, or does it unsettle teachers and do you end up teaching to it and, you know, perhaps skewing your teaching?
I think, I would say for 90% of the time it's taken in your stride because actually you are aware of what the children need to be able to do. But what they need to be able to do is not necessarily what they need to be able to do for their SATs. However, prior to the SATs, and that's whether or not you're doing your year six SATs or you're doing the optional SATs that you might do for the rest of the year, you do, and if your hand on your heart, you do have a little think about, now, what is it that I haven't done? What haven't I done for a bit? Have I not done a bit of data handling for a bit? Have I not thought very carefully about, I don't know, have I not looked at my, where we put semicolons in? And you do have a little bit of a revise, not using highlighters, obviously, as from our first conversation. You do have a little bit of a revise before the SATs happen. Now, in terms of kind of your year three, year four, year five, those are optional SATs, and we do use our teacher assessment as well. But in
someone's
terms
got a phone going. Can you hear that as well?
Yeah, it's beeping. It's not me.
Steve,
oh,
put
yes,
your phone
it is me.
Away.
Sorry. It's my fault. I've just got a text. It's from my head, it's from my head teacher. He's probably listening.
Join the podcast.
What was I talking about?
SATs.
I think year six teachers particularly are very, very pressured. And I think it's very easy as a year six teacher to forget that actually the culmination of what they get in their SATs at the end of year six, that's for 7 years of the children's hard work and the teacher's hard work. But I think year six teachers really do feel a huge pressure because that's what gets reported. And it's kind of, they feel that it's their responsibility. And I think a lot of the time, a lot of year six before SATs kind of is very much geared towards the SATs rather than other things, really. It's because of the pressure. It really is because of the pressure. It's really difficult. I wouldn't want to teach year six. So
critics such as Michael Rosen would, you know, would kind of.
I love Michael Rosen.
Yeah,
and brilliant.
And his blog's great. And although we've had a guest on the program who's taken issue with him big time, so which is always good for it. So here's to you, Anne. But Michael Rosen, I mean, has argued that the danger of all this drilling and testing is obviously we drive the creativity out of the process, you know, and that. The writing is a flexible and fluid process, which, yes, of course, you need some basic skills, and nobody's denying that. But, I don't know what your views on that are in regards to sort of pedagogy in the school.
Yeah. I remember when I was first teaching, and I'd probably been teaching a couple of years, and somebody said to me, and this was in my first job, when we were thinking about SATs, and this would have been gosh, well, quite a long time ago, late 90s, somebody said to me, actually, if we want all of our children to get to a level four in the writing, there's a bit of a formula you can do so we can all teach them that. So you can say, make sure that you start your writing with speech marks and put this in, this in, this in. You can basically teach to a formula. And I think that's where we're in a danger of going, because if we teach to a mark scheme, then you're going to, those things are going to happen. You're going to, you know, if you're looking for ellipses and you're looking for various different things and you're looking for, I don't know, I've only just marked my options, that's the other day and it's all gone from my head. I think we are in danger of knocking the creativity out of things. And a lot of the teaching that we've been working from, you know, on a lot of the things that we call magpieing and kind of taking those really good ideas from authors that we love and using those in our own work, not plagiarism, magpieing, but kind of using those those author conventions. I think that because sometimes we are concentrating so much on the technicality, that some of those natural writers that need to that could kind of really hone their skills, it can sometimes be knocked out of them. Yeah. And there's this, I think children, because we are, you know, we have to say, you know, that's brilliant, but this is what you need to do next. That's brilliant, but this is what you need to do next. There's that feeling for the children that nothing is ever quite good enough. And, that, you know, that it's difficult to be children, isn't it? And, yeah, you know, yeah.
Who was it that said that school was basically a place where you're supposed to learn, and I think the quote was, exactly how dissatisfied with yourself you should be?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, can't recall who that was. It is a quote from someone or a
But that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because what is the crisis that this curriculum tinkering and this constant tinkering is supposed to address? Mm. I mean, yes, sure, there are a number of children who are failing and leaving with poor literary skills, but is it all down to?
But it's the defining the failing, though, isn't it? What are they saying is failing?
Mm.
This is a problem, you know, if we're saying failing is not coming out as a mid-level, you know, as a mid-level four at the end of year six, why is, for some children, that might not be failing. For some children, that is failing because they're perhaps not up to their potential. But, you know, the parameters have changed so much that how is it that the expected level for the end of year six is now not good enough? It's not children not reading, is it?
Yeah.
It's, you know,
I mean, that's right.
The whole definition is flawed.
Yeah. And that's the really complex question. It's just, as you said, where exactly is the heart of this crisis that these reforms are meant to be addressing? Is it because, you know, is there a limit to how far we can push children, or are we not pushing children far enough? Is it because
Or are we improving our techniques in school, but meanwhile, the literacy influences outside school are negative ones.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems to be kind of more and more, it's the school's fault because the literacy levels aren't high enough. You know, and it's always somehow the schools can solve it. It seems to be, it's obviously a wider social issue, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's this big issue with children coming into school with a lack of conversational skills, with not having a high level of spoken English, which, you know, we can address that at school, but there's a much bigger issue, isn't there?
Yeah.
Much bigger issue.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned there about the goalposts changing. I mean, so there's a couple of questions just because we're soon running out of time here. I mean, one is about the goalposts that you're inspected on, the Ofsted that changes. So just to say something about that. The second question is, I mean, what do you think's in the new curriculum that is going to shift the goalposts in English primary teaching?
Well, to be honest, in the new English curriculum, it doesn't, quite frankly, look particularly different to me. It's not hugely different from what we are doing at the moment. What looks different is kind of some of the terminology that they use. I don't like the terminology when they use transcription. I don't like that. That sounds a bit like we're going to school in 1950. But
well, Go thinks we ought to.
Well, yeah, well, there we go. That's probably why it's there, isn't it? Now, just mention that word, Steve.
Take a glug of wine, Matthew. Yeah.
Hey, cranberry and sparkling water tonight. I want it noticed for Matthew's alcoholism watch online.
Very, very healthy, Matthew. There's not, I think because we've been very conscious over the last few years and there has been all these changes already, you know, we've got the SPAG test coming in and we've had the phonics review and that's happening. And you know, the basis of the, you know, the phonics is still in the new curriculum. I don't think there's a massive change in terms of that of what we're doing at the moment. What seems a little bit different is kind of it's that move away. There doesn't seem to be a lot of enjoyment in there.
Oh yeah.
There's just not, you know,
we can't have people enjoying themselves.
No, and we went from this whole excellence enjoyment thing with the Labour government and, you know, children understanding
where enjoyment, Ted Rugg was mentioned 3 times in the document.
Yeah.
As opposed to excellence, which was like 70 times. Yeah. Sorry,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Excellence. But there's, you know, there's this excellence and enjoyment thing, but at least there's some kind of philosophy behind the thing that there might be some amount of enjoyment in there at some point. Whereas it's very, I don't know, you know, it's a draft. It's not there. We can't see it in, you know, we can't see how it's necessarily going to relate into our classroom teaching at the moment. But, you know, there is the, you know, reading for different reasons, including for pleasure, is one of the ones that kind of strikes me. I think that was out, I teach year three currently, and that's out the year three or four kind of program of study. But reading for a number of reasons, including for pleasure. Now, surely reading for pleasure should be the heart of it. And that's what they should be saying first.
Yeah. You might get some pleasure out of it. But actually, So just coming on to the other question then, I mean, you talked about shifting goalposts. I mean, and the shifts in the Ofsted regimes, aren't they, that you're now subject to?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I've not had an inspection under the new regime, so I can't comment on it completely. But it's the new Ofsted regime. Everything, absolutely everything, is about achievement, absolutely everything, which is obviously extremely important because that is why children are going to school, because, you know, we want the best for them and we want them to achieve. But what used to be kind of expected progress for children in your class now is not good enough, and the things move, and it's like the whole judgment of satisfactory, the word satisfactory would imply that it was okay, because that's what the word means. You had your satisfactory, you had your good, and you had your outstanding. Now, obviously, every single teacher aspires to having those outstanding lessons, because then hopefully the children will be achieving as much as they possibly can. However, you know, in a perfect world, that's what it would be like. Not necessarily there, but now in Ofsted, satisfactory is not satisfactory. Satisfactory is needs improvement. And you are, because everything is about achievement, so we're talking about, you know, it's the value added, it's the progress that the children make from the end of Key Stage 1 to the end of Key Stage 2, which I have always found slightly confusing, in that if you're in a primary school and you're measuring the achievement from the end of Key Stage 1 to Key Stage 2, you'd kind of be better off with your Key Stage 1 and Foundation Stage teachers not doing a great deal, so you'd got really poor results in the infants, so that then you could show brilliant value added at the end of Key Stage 2, because it's all about achievement, kind of what I'm going to say in the olden days, because my brain is now going to mush, what previously would have been thought of as really good achievement, that's now not good. That is now only satisfactory because everything has got to show that accelerated progress. So if we're talking children at the end of Key Stage 1 achieving a level 3, which is stunningly brilliant, all of those children, for you to get a good rate of achievement, all of those children at the end of year 6 have got to get a level 6. Now that is huge. That's huge.
Wow.
That's huge to show good progress. Because level 5, those children at the end of Key Stage 1 getting a level 3, their expected progress would be to level 5 at the end of Key Stage 2.
But it's now not good enough.
But that's now, that's not good enough. That
this has become slightly bewildering for for your non-English listeners in terms of the grades, but I think it's okay. I think we got a flavour of that. Yeah, it's the raised expectation, and it's not a slight one. It's a kind of a quantum leap in terms of raised expectation.
You've got to pedal even harder. And if you're not pedalling hard enough, then the school's going to be failed by Ofsted, and it has all sorts of impacts, doesn't it?
We're back to the horse's head again, then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'm just very, very aware of the time here. And Matthew, have you got any sort of final questions or comments on there?
Just a couple of clarifying ones, really. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and it's actually made me realise that, as we've discussed, we haven't had enough recent guests from England on the programme. Because I've just really been soaking it up and to hear a lot more about it. But, were you serious about your idea, Louisa, that you... in a sense, should not try so hard in Key Stage 1, which is first half of primary, really, isn't it, for non-English listeners?
Of course not, no. It is frustrating.
But is that part of why there's a SAT at that level? Is there a SAT at that level, is really what I'm asking?
We have to report on levels at the end of Key Stage 1, so for the seven-year-olds. We have to report on levels, and those are, although they're not published as the end of Key Stage 2 levels are, the year sixes, though they're not published, they are what everything is then measured against.
Okay. And my second thought really is just that you sound to me like an incredibly enthusiastic teacher, and the joking earlier, it just comes across that you really know your craft and you're really immersed in it. How is the morale in English primary schools?
I mean, I can only speak for my school, really. And I am very lucky. I work in a fantastic school. I have a fantastic head teacher. I have a fantastic team of people, fantastic parents. We are very fantastic kids. We're very, very lucky. But morale is, it's not an all-time high. I'll put it that way. It's not an all-time high. It's a difficult time. It's a difficult time at the moment. And I think in other schools where there's been, you know, when they've had to face different challenges, you know, we're a very stable staff at my school, an experienced staff, we're very welcoming. But, if you're at a school that has a higher turnover of staff, that's in a challenging area that has different problems, then, the morale, some teachers are finding it very difficult at the moment, I think. Very difficult. And I think it's just, it's in the media a lot, isn't it? And it's difficult for people to hear them, to be criticised continuously. And I think that's the biggest part of the morale, when you work very, very, very hard for the love of the job, really.
And it comes across. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Which comes back to our original point about you mentioned at the beginning, recruitment crisis. So it doesn't, it's not very hopeful for the future if we're trying to attract enthusiastic teachers like yourself.
No.
Louisa, this has been a brilliant conversation. I'm hoping now that we've sorted out the technology, hopefully you've enjoyed the conversation, you'll come back and join us in the future. And
I would love to. I've enjoyed
it. You know me, Steve,
I can talk a lot.
We've got no danger of drying up, which is always good. We like a loquacious guest.
We do like a bit of that. You're absolutely right. Yes, voluble is good with us.
Yeah.
You never get criticised in Inside Learning for that. In a classroom, yes, you talk too much before getting down to the activity. Not here.
So it's been great to have you on the podcast, Louisa. So thank you very much.
Steve. Thanks, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
Lovely to meet you tonight, Louisa. Yep. Hopefully see you again soon.
And you. Yep. Yeah, take
good
care.
Good night.
Okay, night.
Night.